Hello everyone and welcome to My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the great landmark albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris and I'd like to thank you very much for tuning in, be this your first episode or be this your fourth. There were so many people listening throughout October. Episode 3 about Led Zeppelin 2 was our most listened to episode so far, and I logged in to my podcast host halfway through the month just to have a look and just see how many listeners we were getting, and I'd seen that Episode 3 actually had as many listeners halfway through the month as episodes 1 and 2 had had in their entire first month. So that's fantastic news. Not only that, but people were going back and revisiting the others. So there must be something about My Classic Album that's leaving a great impression with you all. So thank you all very much for being on board. Now, an interesting piece of information about episode 2 of My Classic Album. Now, you may remember that Ian Matthews and I sat down and we discussed the fantastic Radiohead album, OK Computer. Now, through the month of September, we got all sorts of great feedback for that album. But what was really cool was towards the end of October, Radiohead actually announced that they'd be headlining the Glastonbury Festival next year. And when I logged on to the website just to see kind of how the listening figures were for this month, I saw that there was actually a massive spike for episode 2. Loads of people listening to that particular podcast on the day and the day after Radiohead announced their Glastonbury headline set. So I hope anyone who is getting excited for Glastonbury and geared up to see Radiohead enjoyed the episode. And by all means, spread the word if you think that me and Ian kind of did that album justice. If you think we didn't, whatever, just kind of pass it around. And again, that's the joy of My Classic Album, that, you know, you're not necessarily going to agree with everything we say, but it's just cool to talk about music, and it's so cool to hear people who are passionate about music talking about their favourite album. Now, if this is your first episode of My Classic Album, you really couldn't have picked a better time to kind of get involved. The next few episodes are, the risk of sound big-headed, are going to be really, really great. Today's episode is no exception. Good Old Boys by Randy Newman is the album that we're going to be looking at today, and that was picked by my special guest, a fantastic blues rock musician from the States called Reed Turchie. I'd not actually even heard of this album when he picked it. We'd been talking via email, and he'd sent me two or three albums that he would potentially like to cover on My Classic Album. And for some reason, the Randy Newman one kind of stood out to me, even though all I really knew of Randy Newman was kind of his film scores and his work on the Toy Story movies. And what I learned, as I'm sure you will from this podcast, is that there's so much more to Randy Newman than merely film scores and You've Got a Friend in Me. He's a very fearless artist, and you'll kind of get that when me and Reed are talking about sort of the themes explored on the album and why he's chosen to kind of cover them in the way that he has. In a really random coincidence, and it's not the first time that this has happened since we started recording My Classic Album, Randy Newman has actually released some new material in the time that we've been putting this episode together. So he's released a song called Pewin. It's available online. And it's very similar in tone and style to Good Old Boys. And once you've listened to this episode, you'll see what I mean. But it's just this kind of, it's unmistakably Randy Newman. And that's something that I wouldn't have been aware of even a couple of months ago. But it's just a great song, as are the tracks on Good Old Boys. And when Reed and I sat down and talked about this album, it was just this all-encompassing conversation. We kind of even went beyond the scope of music as we explored the themes that he has covered on the album. And for me, it was really enlightening. Reed, as I said, is from the States. I'm from the northeast of England. And as I said to him once or twice in the conversation, my experience, my life experience, is just radically different from the things that are being talked about on Good Old Boys. So not only did I get to learn about a fantastic album, but I got to learn a bit about American history as well, which you'll see. And it's, I really hope you enjoy it, because I really enjoyed recording it with Reed. I really enjoyed putting this episode together. So hopefully you'll get a lot out of it. Now, if you like the show on Facebook, which you can do by searching for My Classic Album with Mike Norris, you may have seen an event that I shared a couple of times in October. Adrian Nation, who is a phenomenal guitarist that you might know from the Sky Art series Guitar Star or from his recent live album Live at Crossroads, he was in the region for a few nights in the Northeast, and he was playing a couple of shows. Thanks to a very good friend of mine, Ian Gordon, who I know from university, I managed to be able to sit down with Adrian Nation in Newcastle towards the end of October, and we had a really awesome chat about one of his favourite albums, an album that he selected for My Classic Album, and that will be the basis of next month's episode of the podcast. So if you are an Adrian Nation fan and you're curious as to what album he's picked, just wait until the end of the episode and I'll reveal all. I'll let you know the album that Adrian and I discussed in Newcastle on that rainy night in October. Now, the way things usually go on My Classic Album is that the special guest picks the album that we're going to be discussing. For example, today, Reed Turchie's picked Good Old Boys. But on February's edition of My Classic Album, things are going to be a little bit different. And that's because we have a fantastic album that's going to be 40 years old. On the 3rd of February 2017, Rumours by Fleetwood Mac is going to be 40 years old. And I thought that was too big an opportunity to pass by. So I'm currently in the process of putting together a special episode, 40 Years of Rumours. Now, I believe that the guest for that episode is all sewn up, but I kind of want to hear from you for this one. I think Rumours is just such a personal album to a lot of people. Whenever I talk to people about Rumours, or indeed that kind of era of Fleetwood Mac, people just get really excited. And I want to hear some of your memories and stories associated with this album. Maybe you were lucky enough to meet the band or see them in concert and you've got kind of a memory attached to that. Or maybe it's just a cool story or a funny story or whatever, that whenever you hear Rumours, you're just right back there. So if you have any memories or stories associated with this album that you'd like to share, please get in touch, and the best ones will find some kind of way to share them on the 40 Years of Rumours episode of My Classic Album. If you go on Facebook, as I just said before there, search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris, and you could send me a private message, or you could leave a post on the wall with your story. Alternatively, you can follow us on Instagram, or you could tag us in an Instagram post, and that's My Classic Album Podcast, or as my wife put it to me a couple of weeks ago, My Classical Bum Podcast. So you could send a direct message, you could tag us, you could even possibly post a video. Again, just sharing your memories of Rumours. Again, over on Twitter, at @MCA_podcast, you could tweet me or direct message me your memories of the album. Or if you've got something that's a bit longer, or maybe something that you want to keep a little more private, you can email me at mikenorris339@live.com. And again, you could send an audio file, it could just be a written email, it could even be a video file, and we'll find some way to incorporate all of the best ones into the February episode of My Classic Album, 40 Years of Rumours. Right, so I think I've rambled on for long enough. I'm very excited to let you hear, as I said, this conversation with Reed Turchie. So today's episode of My Classic Album is about the Randy Newman album, Good Old Boys. Now, for those who are still getting acquainted with the album, here's just a little look at everything you need to know about Good Old Boys. Good Old Boys was the fifth studio album by American singer-songwriter Randy Newman. Released on the 10th of September 1974 on Reprise Records, the album was recorded at Warner Brothers Studios in Hollywood, California. Russ Titelman, who worked on many of Newman's albums, served as producer, along with president of Warner Brothers Records, Lenny Waronker, who's also known for working with the likes of James Taylor and Rufus Wainwright. On the same day as the album's release, Guilty, a Newman composition from the album, previously performed by Bonnie Raitt, was released as the first single, with Naked Man on the B-side. Standout track Louisiana 1927 was also released as a single on January 29th, 1975, with Marie as its B-side. While the singles failed to chart in the US, the album itself was the beginning of commercial success for Randy Newman. Good Old Boys peaked at number 36 on the Billboard 200. Meanwhile, the album certified gold in the Netherlands. Shortly after the album's release, Newman staged a live premiere of the album on October 5th, 1974, at the Symphony Hall in Atlanta, where he performed the album, accompanied by Ry Cooder and the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. Praise for Good Old Boys has been strong over the years, with critics highlighting Newman's bravery and humour while tackling things such as racism and class divisions throughout the album. Esteemed music journalist Robert Christgau gave the album an A rating upon its release, while five-star reviews came from AllMusic.com and Rolling Stone in the years that followed. Speaking of Rolling Stone, the magazine named Good Old Boys within its 500 Greatest Albums of All Time in 2003. So that's everything you need to know about Good Old Boys, and with me I have my very special guest who picked this album for our conversation, Mr. Reed Turchie. How's it going?
It's going really well. Thanks for having me on board.
So I guess the first question, and I ask this to everybody, the first question has to be why you've picked Randy Newman's Good Old Boys as your classic album.
Well, Randy Newman is someone who I was always sort of around growing up. It's someone that my parents always had playing in the house, so it's a name that has always been sort of significant to me. And then I hadn't realized quite how in Randy's world I was living, but you know, he does a couple soundtracks, obviously the mega hits like the Toy Story soundtracks, but there's a Robert Redford movie I love called The Natural. It's a baseball movie from the early 70s, and that soundtrack actually got panned as being far too corny when it came out. And if you listen to it, it's great. It's sort of very Aaron Copland-esque, but it's obviously very strong and sort of iconic. But for this album, I think what really fascinates me is the songwriting lyrically, combined with some of the arrangements too. And it's an album that I only enjoy more and keep finding things within it that I appreciate. Some of the first songs I learned on piano were songs of his. And then I've been working my way through a bunch of the songs on guitar and then playing the song with my band. And that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, obviously, this is a UK-based show. And while Randy Newman's had a very storied career, he's perhaps a bit underappreciated over here, which I think is a real shame. As you'd alluded to, he's very much kind of into soundtracks and film scores now. And I think over here, he's most closely associated with the Toy Story movies.
Yeah, of course.
I don't know. I thought it might be a really good idea to just maybe talk a little bit about Randy and his career for anyone who maybe he has kind of passed people by, maybe in the UK.
Yeah, well, I can't remember exactly the number, but he was nominated for some absurd amount of Academy Awards. I'm going to say somewhere between 10 and 15 before he ever finally won. And so, yeah, he comes from sort of a soundtrack in L.A. family. I believe it was either an uncle or a grandfather of his that did that, like Fox Pictures, like dun-da-dun, 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 like that's his family legacy. So, you know, he's been around the business for a while, but then the songs he writes that are on his albums are incredible to me. For he talks about a wide range of things, some lighthearted things, some really serious things, but he always does it with a tone that never comes off as, you know, preaching or just, you know, oh, I'm down in the dumps or any of that. They're really poignant and kind of human songs and really clever in how they work lyrically with flipping around perspectives and using different points of view. So if anyone was getting in a sort of a crash course in non-movie Randy Newman, the two albums of his that I would point to are Sail Away and then, of course, this one, my favorite, Good Old Boys.
And I think when I was listening to the album, the humor comes through so much as well. Like, he can be talking about something that's quite melancholy, but he has this really kind of wry sense of humor, which I think is just apparent throughout the entire album.
Yeah, yeah, the sense of humor, and even to this day, it is amazing. He has no fear about taking on any topic. And I read an interview with him recently where he said that he no longer plays live the song Redneck. So I've seen him do it a couple of times, and it's really interesting to see how different audiences respond to that, because, of course, on one hand, it seems like it might be celebrating rednecks. On one hand, it seems like it might be making fun of rednecks. And then it sort of all flips around and is sort of criticizing the, you know, hypocritical people who may live the same way, but condemn a certain group of people. You know, it really hits everyone. And so, yeah, it's brilliant. But he's done with that song, but now apparently his children have requested that he no longer perform the song Korean Parents when he performs in LA, which is all about this sort of crazy American trend where, especially in Los Angeles, where families, you know, like white American families will hire Korean parents to discipline their kids because these, you know, Korean parents we're seeing is have this, like, you know, better sense of discipline and all this. It, you know, of course it gets really cynical really fast, but also, you know, pretty brave to be singing those songs in front of like a whole group of these people, you know, exactly the subject matter. So.
And I mean, as I was kind of doing a bit of research on Randy Newman, a lot of people in the UK may not know that he wrote songs like You Can Leave Your Hat On and Mama Told Me Not to Come. I mean, these are songs that are really well known over here by different artists.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think on, for instance, one of my favorite songs, Guilty off of Good Old Boys, was recorded as a hit by Bonnie Raitt before he even put out the album with his version on it. So yeah, he's always been a song man in that way.
So to kind of bring it back to you a little bit, what are your memories? I know you'd said obviously he was played a lot when you were growing up. What are your memories of discovering this album and maybe more recent memories of the album?
I think I had a piano book of his songs, and there were a couple songs off of this album that I think I knew his. He did a couple records more recently that are just piano, just solo piano, pretty much his whole catalog. And I think I knew some of those versions first. and was interested as a piano player, and was also immediately pretty interested in his lyrical work. And then only, I don't know, more recently, maybe in the last 4 or 5 years, did I really start to dive into these original album versions with the full orchestrations and instrumentations, and they are incredible. Jim Keltner is one of my favorite drummers on earth, and he's on a lot of these. Obviously, it's hard to not be impressed by Ry Cooder. I'm a big slide guitar player and fan, and the string arrangements. There's so much to absorb from these songs, and the songs at the core of them are so good that there's really just a lot to admire from it.
Now, the root of Good Old Boys can be tracked back to 1973, when Newman recorded a sort of a demo concept album about a character called Johnny Cutler.
Yeah, and that's something I didn't know, you know, when I was listening to the album a number of times, but it makes sense. It's perfect in the way he sort of assigned himself a project like that, and then I think it's a sign of success for the album that you don't have to know that to enjoy the songs.
Yeah. I mean, have you heard any of Johnny Cutler's birthday, as it's kind of been named on the re-releases, and does it differ in any way to what became Good Old Boys?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, some of the songs aren't quite as mapped out, and the instrumentation and all is different. There's some of his songs that sneak onto albums sometime that just don't seem quite finished, and it's pretty rare. And for any, you know, for someone like me, they'd be a really good song. But for him, it seems like they're not quite done. And one of those songs is on at the end of an album called Little Criminals, and it's a song called Kathleen, which kind of gets going and then gets really dark, and then sort of leaves it like lingering like that. And that's one of the songs that a lot of people criticize, but I love that he's not afraid to leave something partially done and then rework it later. You know, they're all sort of fluid.
Absolutely. And I guess there's some songs, and we'll touch on this as we go through the album, that kind of almost have an ambiguous feel to them, that kind of you don't really know what's happened to the protagonist or how they're actually feeling despite what they're telling you in the song.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the most overlooked aspects of really great songwriting or storytelling in general, is that you don't have to explain everything. You know, I think there is always, I think people fall into the trap of, like, you know, really not just, you know, describing a situation or a character, but then, you know, really hammering in, you know, this is why they feel this way, or this is how you should feel, or this is how I feel, you know. And I don't know, I much prefer when it's the listener is really left to figure that stuff out for themselves.
When I was listening to the album, you know, to take a song like Take a Wedding in Cherokee, for example, that it's one moment I'd be feeling really sad, kind of feeling so sorry for this guy, but by the end I was kind of amused when he's talking about his mighty sword. So it's almost this kind of double-edged thing where it's like, you know, he's given me permission to kind of go through all these, instead of saying, this is a sad song, be sad, or this is a funny song, laugh.
Yeah.
It's this kind of, this journey that you go on through all of the songs.
Yeah, and I don't want to, you know, sound too much like a giant, like, cult member of, like the Randy Newman, you know, as God church, but I think some of it comes from just really, really just true descriptions of situations, like in part of Marie, self-criticism that doesn't come off as asking for, like, sympathy or pity. Just, I think that rings true to almost everyone who's willing to admit it. You know, some of these moments of that, and you can laugh at it, but it sinks in a little deeper than that because you recognize it, I think.
Now, obviously, we've talked about the really strong songwriting, but I think to merely say that he's like a singer-songwriter is a huge disservice to him. With the, not only obviously does he play piano on the album, but he's an arranger, he's a conductor. Is it fair to say that this was a particular passion project for him, or is that just par for the course with his work?
You know, I'm not completely sure. I think the concept is really, you know, the concept that you don't even have to know existed, but I think that gave it a good structure to make it a really strong album. And I guess he spent a lot of his childhood in Louisiana, and the material does seem especially poignant, and the characters in it you know, man, they really come through strong. So I don't know how he, you know, might have felt about it when he was doing it, but to me, the songs and the cohesion of the album are really special.
And I guess there is something about the fact that he did spend a lot of his childhood there that kind of adds an authenticity to it.
Yeah, it's funny. There is a song of his that I always think is on this album that it's not, that is all about his childhood in New Orleans and in Louisiana. So it's called Dixie Flyer. And I might look like a fool, but I believe that's one of his most sort of autobiographical songs. And I always think it's on this album because of the subject matter, but it's not. But that song kind of hints at a lot of that.
So the ideas and the themes in the demos for Johnny Cutler and his previous album, Sail Away, have carried over into this album. Would you just like to take a minute to kind of tell our audience kind of what some of those themes are on the album?
Themes is always a word I'm terrified of. It is all set sort of in the American South as a setting, and what it ends up being, I think, is sort of brings up characters and sort of everyday characters, but also tied into true historical events and situations. It's just very human, I think. Like you take the song Birmingham. If you had that song from a different artist or totally removed, you would wonder why the song existed. It is so simple on the surface level, you know? It just seems kind of like, okay, you know, cheery, whatever. But if you put it in this album, you start to have a lot more thoughts about, well, are we supposed to think something about this sort of very simple man and simple life? Or, you know, are we supposed to like recognize that as human and just like us? Or are we supposed to be critical because, you know, this guy is clearly, we think, maybe sort of not aware of all of the, you know, racial and civil rights issues going on in Birmingham right around him? And is that a bad thing? You know, it's amazing. I think the themes start to run through so much.
I think it's very, very multi-layered in that sense that you can kind of listen to a song on the surface and it have an initial meaning. But when you kind of think of it in context with something else or just in context with the rest of the album, that it does kind of pick up another meaning entirely. I know that there's themes around kind of racism. Do you know what the reaction was to the album in this regard when it was released?
I don't. I mean, I think, you know, in the social way, I would say that racism and poverty and also just the disconnect of the Deep South from sort of the political machine of the United States are sort of the themes in a social or political way. But, you know, again, I don't think it ever gets preachy, which is really important, since those are the kind of topics that if you're going to talk about in songs, you have to do it in a way that you're not putting yourself on a pedestal and telling your audience that you need to feel a certain way, but you describe it or pose it in a way that people might, you know, maybe let down their guard or maybe not approach it with whatever their position and biases may be. And may connect in a different way. I mean, that's what art does. That's what great art does, is let people open up in a different way. So yeah, I mean, those are definitely themes on the album, but I am very relieved that you don't have to be like a member of any particular political movement to find the songs relevant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think as well, when obviously, I'm from the northeast of England, and life in the northeast of England is possibly about as far away from the things that he's talking about on the album, but I still listened to it and got a really strong sense of the story he was telling, and I could also relate to it, which I think is, as you say, a real skill to have, because there would be a risk that perhaps there'd be a disconnect there, that perhaps if you don't have that kind of life experience, that maybe part of this album will go away, but I really don't think it does. Do you think, having said that, that perhaps the themes that he was exploring might be a reason why this album was kind of missed in the UK?
Maybe. I don't know if he ever really had much commercial success with any of his albums on his own. You know, I mean, he like one of probably the Randy Newman song, non-soundtrack, that most people who I mention Randy Newman to say are, oh, he wrote that song, Short People. I don't know if you know that one, but that, you know, short people got no reason to live. Like, my aunt still hates Randy Newman because that's the only song she associates with him, and she's a short person. but, you know, I mean, you can guess pretty instantly that Randy Newman is not sitting at home, you know, writing really mean songs about people who aren't tall. but I, you know, I don't think that, I think, he's picked up more of a cult following in some ways, but I'm not, I don't think he's not like, anybody's sort of first list hero here. I think pretty much every book or, sort of interview I've read about, different musicians talking about favorite songwriters, though, almost all say, no one writes really great songs anymore except Randy Newman. I think his appreciation within the musical community is through the roof. But otherwise, if I ever find any other Randy Newman fans, I'm pretty freaked out and excited. It's not an everyday thing.
I guess what's great about it, though, is that despite there being perhaps a lack of commercial success at some parts of his career, there is very much a very strong critical success in terms of, you know, that these albums are even now looked back on as really fantastic albums that they should check out.
I'm sorry that no one over there picked it up to review it and, you know, broke it to great fame and fortune, but I mean, it does make sense because at the surface level, because of the content matter and how, you know, how much of a specific place the album sort of, you know, talks about, though that turns out to be very universal. But I can see why reviewers would not be particularly interested in picking something up that, based on the description, might be irrelevant to them.
But I guess what's kind of nice about that, if I think about sort of the albums that I enjoy, there is something almost more special about an album that's almost yours, that not as many people have maybe heard. It's almost like a really well-kept secret that you can say, well, this is absolutely, it's an amazing album. But it's not a Revolver by the Beatles or a Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf. It's not one that's heard by everyone.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's really fun to share and to find people because I don't know if it's just something about his songwriting style or his music, but the people I do find who also really enjoy that album or who I share that album with and who really like it tend to be people that I'd like to be friends with. I don't know if that's good or bad, but it does seem that sort of an appreciation for his type of humor, but also his type of sort of poignancy, personality trait that I go for.
So I think now seems as good a time as any just to go through track by track. So we'll start with Rednecks. Now, we've already started talking about Rednecks a little bit. Randy Newman has said that it's actually one of his favorite compositions.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty amazing that that's how that album begins. You know, the music is great, of course, but it's the riskiest song on the whole album, and yet that's where it starts. But it is sort of a masterclass, and sort of announces in my mind the album's intention because the music really evokes the places that he's talking about, and that begins right there. And you know, it's kind of the tour of the South, hustling around Atlanta in their, you know, alligator shoes, all that kind of stuff. Very specific descriptions of very specific Southern places. Like LSU is the big university in Louisiana. You know, this is super specific, but you know, Atlanta is like one of these sort of business centers of the South, and LSU graduates, among others, you know, usually sort of wind up in Atlanta if they're pursuing certain things. You know, it's so spot on, and the music really does evoke kind of, it swings in sort of a Southern way. It has kind of its own drawl. You know, it's like, oh, okay, here we go. It's great.
I guess that's it. I know, obviously, with that being my first kind of exposure to the album, I instantly felt right in there, as you say, the kind of the music and the sound of it, just instantly, I knew where we were. It made sense to me, and it was just, like you say, a risky start to the album in some ways with some of the themes explored in the song.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know if that song could ever be played on the radio then or now. So I mean, come on. I think, you know, you start your album throwing out maybe the you know, worst word in the American English language And not just that, but not just in like a, in a verse line or something, but right there, fat in the middle of the chorus. That's a bold way to begin.
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of it's framed, from what I could gather from what I was reading up on the song, it's framed around a television appearance with American politician Lester Maddox on the Dick Cavett show. For anyone who doesn't know about that, just again, a bit of background on that TV appearance and kind of how it relates to the song.
Well, just, you know, he's Lester Maddox is, was at the time one of these sort of Southern politicians who at in one way was sort of celebrated and loved in the South for being, you know, just kind of like another guy, regular guy, but became to everyone else, or to a lot of other people, you know, this sort of ignorant fool and this, you know, source of, you know, hatred and racism. And we all know that both of those things can be true at the same time about someone. You know, like, you know, how many people in your own family do you feel that way about, you know? I mean, so, yeah, so the narrator of the song sees this TV appearance where Lester Maddox is really sort of degraded and humiliated on air, and like, you know, that's the line: he may be a fool, but he's our fool, and if you think you're better than him, you're wrong. You know, I mean, we all have these faults, and, you know, blowing somebody up. So yeah, and then for me, the real genius in the song is, and I think I, you know, may have already said this and spilled the beans, but for the first half of the song, it seems that the joke is on the redneck. You know, you can listen to the song and be like, ha, you know, he's just eviscerating these, you know, ignorant people who are so horribly racist and have done such awful things. And then the song flips and goes after all the, you know, racial oppression and problems in the North. And just like it does naming specific places in the South, it names specific kind of ghetto and impoverished neighborhoods in Northern cities. And by the time the song is over, I don't think anyone is left uncriticized, which is perfect, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's kind of, it's exploring both sides. And I know that I'd read an interview with Randy Newman that it said that when he'd seen that interview, that he felt that regardless of Maddox's views, the man had just been elected governor of Georgia. And had he been Georgian himself, he would have been offended at how the state was represented on TV and how their governor had been represented on TV.
Yeah.
So I guess I've kind of answered my own question in some ways, but as you've said, the narrator kind of turns things around on the North towards the end there. I'm guessing that you'd agree with me that that's sort of reflective of Newman's actual views on that situation.
I don't know. I think I have no idea what the actual views are, except I think it's very intentional that in the last chorus, it seems that in terms of who's doing the holding down, it's applying to both sides. The way the last verse moves into the last chorus about you know, people being kept in ghettos and gathered up and held down, everyone kind of becomes a redneck in this specific way. And I think that's, if there's a point or, you know, a one moment to really look at, I think that's when it comes through.
Cool. So if we move on to Birmingham, as we say over here, Birmingham. On the surface, and again, we've discussed this a bit already, on the surface, it could easily just be a song about hometown pride. And it's the idea that if it had been perhaps by another artist, it'd be quite innocuous. But
yeah. But
if we listen, as you'd said, into the context with it, in the history of Birmingham, Alabama, there is kind of a more kind of satirical element to it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if Redneck starts off by talking about, you know, a prominent politician and sort of the national TV level, Birmingham then becomes incredibly focused. It's just one guy, you know, the song is just one guy. He talks about his town, and then he talks about his wife, and then he talks about his dog, and that's it.
Yeah.
And then it's out.
Down the dump.
You know, there's never like another level introduced. The perspective never shifts, you know, like, oh, well, actually this guy, or like, oh, you know, here's this dark thing, or it's straight. It's simple. The music is lighter and, you know, kind of works around more. If Rednecks kind of introduces the whole theme and idea and, sort of hypocrisy being touched on in the album. Birmingham, I feel like, is then zooming in and taking the straightest, simplest, smallest little introduction.
Yeah, almost kind of like putting this one person under a microscope almost.
Yeah, and yet not really sort of revealing anything in a, like, in a dissecting way, which, you know, I think that someone a little more overtly heavy-handed, and that this is, I'm getting deep into my own speculation, so, you know, this could be 1,000% wrong, but, you know, I think if someone was being more heavy-handed, they might describe this character, but do it sort of omnisciently, and then talk about him, and maybe him and something about the civil rights, or him and maybe something about a little bit of his, you know, like maybe his poverty, or, you know, him, you know, like take a little edge to it. Whereas this is just first person, you know, Birmingham. That's it.
Yeah. And I read a review of the track on of the album, in fact, on thevinyldistrict.com. And they asked a really, really interesting question, which made me think of the song another way, that is the narrator a racist, or is he simply just clueless and proud of his state? Is he just kind of within his own little bubble and life goes on?
Yeah, or, you know, I think my answer would be both. And I think that, you know, I mean, it's the same sort of Lester Maddox paradox, too. It's, you know, you can have a happily small sort of life like that and be happy about those things and yet also be sort of wrapped up in this context of, you know, things going. I just love that it's Randy Newman on that song doesn't show his cards either way. And I think the only reason we're talking about this song so much is because we can put all of our own speculation and thoughts into it, and there's no answer in the song.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about it.
I mean, even, I don't know if it was if it was the vinyldistrict.com or elsewhere that I'd read this, but there was some speculation at the end when, again, about Dan the dog, where it's get him, Dan, and it's kind of, who's Dan getting?
Yes,
and
that's the only moment in the whole song where there is just that little bit of an edge. You know, dogs especially, and, you know, a civil rights concept. Yeah, you're exactly right. That's the one moment where you think maybe a little something is being shown. But then, why are we thinking that? You know? Yeah. I talked about his dog.
Yeah, and I guess that's it. You know, when we said earlier, it's he gives us the opportunity to make our own mind up to feel how we feel about things. And I guess from you saying that it just kind of made me reflect on why, obviously, I'd read that and I thought, oh, that makes sense to me. But it maybe says something about how I interpret the song as well. He literally is, as you said, it's all speculation on our part.
Yeah, which is, you know, what good art does, thought-provoking things.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
What a fantastic guest Reed Turchie has been so far on My Classic Album, and there's still plenty of our conversation coming up for the rest of the podcast. Reed tells us why one of the tracks on Good Old Boys has a particular resonance after Hurricane Katrina, and I struggle to find out why exactly there is a naked man. That's all coming up right after this.
They'd never done anything like this album before, ever. There was such a mix of stuff on it.
Would you like to get involved with the discussion on My Classic Album? Or maybe you'd like to be a guest on a future episode?
I don't think there's any other album that is so poignant and so human in its lyrics.
Like us on Facebook by searching for My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Alternatively, you could follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or even tweet us over at MCA_podcast. And who knows, you could be chatting with me very soon about your classic album.
Now for me, it's the music that gets me with this one. It's just beautifully put together, in my opinion.
Make sure you never miss an episode and keep up to date with all the latest news at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk.
So if we take Marie, it's a love song from the perspective of a drunk.
Yeah, which is all of us, right? I mean, we don't know if he's sort of chronically drunk or anything, but, you know, he's sort of professing his love or why he's always loved her, or that he always will love her. And then, you know, at the same time, he is totally you know, tearing himself up and explaining why, in fact, he is probably such a bad partner, or, you know, whatever, you know, going back and forth between these really beautiful love song lyrics and then just tearing himself to bits, right? You're the song that the trees sing when the wind blows. You're a flower. You're a river. You're a rainbow. I mean, you know, this is so cloying that if the song was only like that, we'd all, you know, kind of roll our eyes and groan. But then right after that, the same verse, you know, sometimes I'm crazy, which is, okay, not the biggest thing. But I guess, you know, I'm weak and I'm lazy. Okay, now we're getting dark. And then, and I've hurt you so, you know, now we're really down on the bottom. I don't listen to a word you say. When you're in trouble, I just turn away. I mean, that's pretty nasty. And then, I love you. I loved you the first time I saw you. I always will love you, Marie. It's like, woof, you know, you kind of run the whole emotional gambit in a verse there.
And again, when we're talking about it being from the perspective of a drunk, it is very much, I remember when I was kind of, you know, I don't drink as much now as I used to, but when I was a teenager, I was a student at university, everything's so much more dramatic when you're drunk, and everything's so much like, oh, wow, I need to talk to this person. And that, I think that, like you say, running the mill of emotions and going through it all in that such a frantic way, that is almost being love drunk, I guess.
Oh, yeah. It's, yeah. Yeah, it's one of those songs that's such a pleasure to listen to, and then, you know, can resonate so deeply. That's a good one.
And I guess it is quite dark in the way that we've talked about that he always has to be drunk in order to tell her how he feels. And in some ways, he's not likely to change anytime soon. He knows his faults, but it doesn't seem like anything's going to change.
Yeah, I mean, I'm drunk right now, baby, but I've got to be, or I never could tell you what you meant to me. It's like, whoa.
And I mean, from what I've looked up here, Marie and Birmingham were written after Rednecks in order for Newman to explain where it was all coming from. They kind of grouped together very nicely, and they almost made the album at the start there. It feels very thematic and contextual at that point.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's wise. He comes out of the gates with Rednecks, which is so very and, you know, unapologetically political in its ways. And then Birmingham and Marie sort of take a break from that, but enforce some, you know, more human emotions and elements. But, I mean, we talked about the hints in Birmingham that maybe there's something larger. But, you know, we really are getting more into, like, character portraits than, you know, continued. If every song was as political as Rednecks, I think we'd all turn the album off. There has to be balance.
Yeah. And I guess that's, like you say, that's the joy of it, that kind of it starts off with this very bold political statement, but then it humanizes more, and it's almost zooming in, like you say, on these individual characters and kind of how they feel within this kind of world.
Yeah. Yep.
Mr. President, have pity on the working man. I know that when I first listened to the album before kind of going in and doing a bit more research, for me, it was almost set within the same sort of time period. It's actually, from what I've gathered, it's a direct plea to Richard Nixon, who was president at the time that the album was released.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think that may well be one of the points, is that those ways the eras are not different. You know, the same things are running through. And what I really like about that is, since we've had Birmingham and Marie by now, the voice of the, you know, the narrator and Mr. President is really simple, but at this point we know it's not simple in a way that's supposed to be dumb, or in a simple in a, like, a sloppy songwriting way. You know, I mean, the lines are really simple. They're just very conversational phrases. They're not the words are simple, the rhymes are simple in a very casual way, not in a weak way, just in a very casual way that makes it fit.
So there's some tracks that we've already heard and some that are coming up later on that kind of highlight this north-south divide almost that's kind of resonating in Louisiana and other places. Can I gather that when Nixon was in power in the 70s, that again, that was still very much an issue, and that these places felt overlooked?
Yeah, I think that's always the case. I mean, you can look at what happened when... you can look at what is happening now, but you can look at what happened with Hurricane Katrina and, you know, what was the soundbite when Kanye West was on air and said, you know, George Bush doesn't care about black people. You know, in that case, it was particularly racial, but it's the same thing. And you look at, if you're really a nerd, which I may or may not be, no, I definitely am. there's a great book called Rising Tide, which talks about the 1927 flooding that was not just in New Orleans, but was really the whole Mississippi Delta, which is, many states and hundreds of square miles. But anyway, the sort of political and economic reasoning that led to some of those neighborhoods and areas being more at risk for this kind of devastation are exactly the same sort of institutional issues that led to which neighborhoods were flooded in Katrina, and really which neighborhoods are going to disappear now as, you know, the water keeps coming up. It's the same thing. And so, yeah, this is, you know, you can blend all the eras together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think once we get into Louisiana 1927, which is obviously coming up in a couple of tracks time, that's something that we can talk about even more, because obviously there's a lot of resonance with Hurricane Katrina in that song, which we can kind of touch on in a little while.
Yeah.
So before we do that, though, we'll go for Guilty, which, as you'd said earlier, was originally a Bonnie Raitt song that he then reworked for, well, obviously he wrote it for Bonnie Raitt, but he then reworked it for the album.
Yeah, and this is a song that I've played with my band for months now, and I really love to play it. It's just so beautifully sort of self-critical and honest, and as a song, it's really fun. Recently, whenever anyone, you know, like asks me to play a song or whatever, that's been my go-to. But just such poignant lines, you know, how come everything, what is it? How come I never do what I'm supposed to do? How come everything that I do never turns out right? It's the same. I'm running out of words and I feel like I keep saying the same thing, but it's the same sort of mood and really clear self-depiction that's in that part of Marie. You know, I know I shouldn't come here anymore, but I don't have anywhere else to go. You know, it's like, it's immediately recognizing the sort of faults and the problem with the character's self, and yet that's what it is. You know, and again, I don't think it ever comes across as asking for like sympathy or pity or poor me or, oh, I've ruined my life, poor me, any of that. So I'm a big fan. I don't know if that makes any sense. If you're listening and if everything I just said sounds like garbage, ignore it and just try it out.
I think what particularly linked for me there when you were talking was the comparison to Marie, because that's kind of what I felt when I was listening to the song, that it was almost a continuation of that kind of self-loathing. And it was almost as if we were kind of still with the same character again.
Yeah, and I think that's the key to the album in a way, is how consistent the voice is in some of these songs.
So I read a review of the album by Rolling Stone, and it came up with it was right at the end, it was a really interesting kind of statement, and I'm undecided as to whether I agree with it. They were saying that behind the brilliance of the album is this kind of morbidity, and that it gives the impression that Newman himself is a troubled man, or was a troubled man at the time. Is that an assessment you would agree with, or do you think it is just these character portraits that he's just so adept at kind of plunging into?
Oh, I think it's certainly true. You know, I don't think anyone who, it's like, you know, how many comedians sit at home by themselves and just laugh all the time? none. You know, I think that you can't, some of these insights and levels of humanity you can't depict so accurately without, whether it's, you know, with himself or people he loves and spends time with. You know, I mean, there is a sort of necessary level of experience to talk about some of these things, but ultimately I appreciate how he turns it into art, and I actually think one of the sort of most frustrating, and I don't know what it is, but as a trend in general, I find it frustrating when, like for authors in book world or in songwriters, you know, that it's only, you know, well, is this really you? You know, like, oh, is Randy Newman really this racist guy? You know, it's like, the point is he's getting it outside of himself, I think. But no, I mean, I don't think Randy Newman is this just endlessly chipper guy. I think there's a level of, one interview with him, you know, someone asked if he had, you know, it's like, well, your songs are often very sort of cynical. Do you have any hope for humanity? And he says, you know, if I'm sitting in the doctor's office and talk to the person next to me, I'll probably end up liking them and having a nice conversation with them. But I don't trust us all as a big group, you know. It's you know, that kind of self-awareness and thought, I don't think what's you. It's not exactly the ignorance is bliss approach to life, that's for sure.
So if we move on to Louisiana 1927, which, just as a little side note, I'd say is probably my favorite song on the album from listening through to it.
Yeah,
I just thought it was just everything about it was just fantastic, really. I mean, obviously, we'll go into the lyrics and the themes exploring in a minute. Musically, it just kind of builds and builds and builds. Do you think that's a good example of the kind of work that he would later do in kind of film scores and soundtracks?
Yeah, I think that it is one of the strongest songs in that it's just so direct. And again, the string arrangements, I think, are really phenomenal. And it has it's a very Newman-esque kind of shuffle, and it's almost a little bit of a ragtime feel. And I think that's really appropriate for, you know, a lot of the Louisiana themed songs lyrically. It's really like, you know, two strengths complementing each other. And that's definitely, Louisiana 1927 is definitely one of the most covered songs of his, especially since Hurricane Katrina. I mean, I've heard a lot of people play it in New Orleans, and a lot of Louisiana-based artists covering it live as kind of their anthem of home. So, yeah, that's a song of his that I think has transcended to a much wider audience.
And I mean, I've got a quote here, which I believe was from the New York Times, where Randy Newman said that when I watched the Katrina footage on CNN, I'd see people on the roofs that I knew. I said, damn, when's the cavalry coming? The cavalry comes every time. Why not now? When I used to sing that song, it was about something that happened a long time ago. Now when I sing it, it's about something that happened to me and my family, so it's a lot more real.
Yeah, well, I think... I mean, I think that issue is only going to continue, especially if, we'll see how November turns out. But I think there could be a lot of people. Well, already there are a lot of people that the cavalry does not come for, but that might only increase here. But I mean, historically, it's really messy, but really interesting, the sort of federal government's involvement in attempts to tame the Mississippi River and what priorities have been at stake, or the way that the whole engineering project of trying to contain the Mississippi River is something that has not necessarily been done with the local farmers' interest in mind. You know, there have been other factors at stake that have led to some pretty questionable decisions and have set up some really disastrous scenarios that lead to this kind of flooding. And so I don't think it's at all wrong or an exaggeration to really point a lot of the, you know, the blame for some of these things at this sort of distant, not so, you know, well-known or compassionate federal government. So then when that fails, I think, of course, there's a lot of resentment. And then when there's no aid, or there's very slow or sort of piecemeal aid, then yeah, it's unbelievable. So yeah, I mean, this is that's a song with a theme that will not go away anytime.
Absolutely. And I know that towards the end of the song, he kind of documents this kind of fictional visit from President Coolidge. And
yeah,
again, kind of really for the song, kind of once again, hammering home this kind of north-south divide, for lack of a better term, that obviously has really kind of come to the fore when we're talking about kind of what's happened with Katrina and other kind of natural disasters.
Yeah, I think the three things are, there's the north-south divide, there's the just kind of, you know, poverty level. You know, we're talking about a lot of very working class or impoverished people in most of these areas that are being so decimated. And, you know, then the third tension is just between federal and local government too, which, you know, I think all three of those things are very clear and, you know, like Rednecks and, you know, Mr. President as well, and, you know, more on the album. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of conflict going on, and it's real, and it is real today. So yeah, song's not going to go away.
So Randy Newman was particularly fascinated by the career of former governor of Louisiana, Huey Long, and that's kind of comes up within the next two tracks. So the first one being Every Man a King, which was actually written by Huey Long.
Yeah. So yeah, Huey Long was the, you know, sort of real people's man of Louisiana, and then of course was, you know, assassinated in the, you know, state house there. So, you know, look what popularity with the common man gets you. But yeah, it's a nice, you know, tribute for him, and it really makes sense in between Louisiana 1927 and Kingfish. And I guess the Eagles sang that.
So I heard. Yeah.
I mean, we haven't talked about some of the music personnel quite as much, but it's worth noting that it's just sort of an unbelievable highlight reel of players involved in it, which, you know, if they want to be involved, then it's a good sign for, you know, the kind of people and talent Newman is attracting.
Absolutely. And I guess that's the risk with an album like this, that kind of there's so much great music going on, but there's just so much to get into kind of thematically and lyrically that sometimes there is a risk of kind of leaving that to the side.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, anyone who hears this and listens to the album will be in for their own treat. And, you know, we can talk about the sort of the content in this way, but honestly, you know, best thing will be for people to like, get to enjoy it themselves.
So Kingfish, which leads on from Every Man a King, which from what I can gather was Long's kind of political slogan while he was kind of around. Yeah. So we've kind of touched on this a little bit already, but it kind of makes Kingfish, Every Man a King, and Louisiana 1927, again, another little kind of tidy section of the album and really almost perfect companions to each other.
Yeah, they all go together nicely. Kingfish is really the arrangements and the instrumentation blow me away. And when this is a Jim Keltner song that he's playing drums on, and when that when it breaks into that section, that is, I think, the sort of, for me, the most badass moment on the record, when it goes into that, you know, you just got to hear it. But, you know, it starts in its one place with kind of the dark swirling strings, and then it really just, it rocks. You know, that's a really, really bad beat that comes in there with Keltner. And, you can feel it, the kind of like, if you think about it too much, the sort of the power of that political movement and of Huey Long's movement, and you can sense that in the way the song kind of starts knocking it out. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's a big part of the song where they're kind of listing Long's achievements over there, such as, you know, taking on the Standard Oil Men and building the highway to Baton Rouge and all these things. Do you believe it's kind of a song from his perspective, or like we were talking about earlier, is it Newman kind of paying tribute to his place in Louisiana's history?
I think in this sense, to me, it sounds more like from his from either Huey Long or someone, deeply in his camp, an enthusiast singing it, you know, at the time, you know, who built the highway to Baton Rouge and all that. It's really declarative. It's fun.
So the next song, Naked Man, the first thing I wrote down when I was listening to it was curiously hilarious.
Yep.
So it's kind of what it says on the tin. It's a naked man running around the city and mugging an old lady. The main question, and I don't expect you to have an answer to this, you may do, why on earth is he naked?
Yeah, well, I think I don't really know how far to attempt to dive in or if there's any point to diving in too far. But there is something about, you know, we've seen these various characters so far in the album who are in different, I'm getting dangerously hypothetical here or theoretical, but who are being stripped of something in one way or another, you know, losing their land, losing their dignity, losing their sort of respect, losing everything around them in ways. And then if you wanted to, you could try to say that, you know, this guy out mugging people is sort of what's happened, you know, kind of the culmination, you know, guy kind of driven crazy, you know, it seems to just sort of embody the whole sort of loss and then desperation that we've been hearing about or witnessing in like a wider sense with, you know.
And I guess this, what's great is that Randy Newman has this kind of talent or knack for kind of taking, you know, a harrowing subject like the mugging of an old lady and somehow bring humor to that, while also, as we've been talking about there, bringing in that kind of the desperation and by the end almost feeling sympathy for the mugger, the naked man.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's none of these characters are so one-dimensional as, you know, the situation might immediately think, you know, or the situation might immediately think, which the more you listen to the album, the more you wonder about Birmingham, which when it comes, you know, when it comes in, you might think it kind of floats under the radar because it is so simple and you've only had one song. But now we've gotten, you know, now you're here. This is why this album just gets better and better to me. I mean, we, you know, you can just fall into this world and amuse yourself forever. And the music's great, you know, perfect.
And I think that's the thing. It's almost kind of that you dropped in this world and you're just kind of walking around and observing these different characters in a moment in time. And I think that's what works really so well with it.
Yep.
Yeah. So again, another one of my favorites, which I did allude to near the start, Wedding in Cherokee County, which again is hilarious, but also really tragic at the same time. And it's again, another example of him kind of almost walking this tightrope of humor and almost a melancholy kind of vibe, and yet never really falling into one too much to kind of spoil the balance.
Yeah, I mean, if you're gonna get sort of if you're gonna be more brutal about yourself, you know, this really takes it to a whole nother level. So yeah, it's funny, you know, there are clever lines. There are just all these things where it's like how the music changes and keeps kind of off balance in Kingfish. You think you've got kind of a structure or a pattern, and then there are just all these levels of kind of jokes or turns within it. But yeah, I mean, come on, you can't, you know, you can't hear the last set, the, you know, she'll laugh at my mighty sword. Why must everybody laugh at my mighty sword? Lord, help me if you will. You can't hear that and not raise an eyebrow. You know, and here we are sort of connected to the naked man in that way too.
And I think that's the thing. It's almost the highlight or the low light for the narrator, depending on how you look at it, this disaster of like a figurative wedding night. And as we both discussed this mighty sword that maybe isn't as mighty as the name would suggest, you know.
No, it's, I mean, there are all these characters, you know, not even necessarily making fun of themselves, because it's not the kind of thing that you would like say to make fun of yourself at a party. You know, it seems much more sort of a few levels deeper than that. And again, you know, just really rings true in a lot of ways.
So, and again, Back on My Feet Again,
mm-hmm.
flirts on this line between kind of humor and tragedy, where it's kind of framed as a conversation between a patient and his doctor. And it's got those kind of funny elements where he's telling this absolutely crazy, almost implausible story. But then the tragedy where it's kind of, how about let me out today, that he's kind of under the doctor's care, perhaps even institutionalized.
Yeah, and you know, I think this is this is, I think, very thematic for the album. And I think kind of like Naked Man, like the narrator here has had his world flipped upside down with, you know, in this case with his sister running off with a black man, and then, you know, like, and then what is this? But then, you know, it flips around, it just flips around again and again. In this one, I take the Get Me Back on My Feet Again as, you know, just, is there any sense to this world? You know, like, try to, like, set my mind straight. And, you know, a lot of a lot of the songs leading up to this, there are a lot of questions about crazy. You know, am I crazy? Is she crazy? Are we crazy? You know what? And then I think this one is it's just a really disoriented perspective. It just builds.
And I think, you know, if you take the three songs that we've just been discussing, Naked Man, Wedding in Cherokee County, Back on My Feet Again, they, as I've said, they kind of have this balance between humour and tragedy. And that kind of melancholy humour is actually like a really British thing. And I think that's one of the reasons that I appreciated the album so much, because I was kind of listening to it, and it is almost that the British, we do like to kind of find humour in desperate situations. And that's something very much that Randy Newman really captures really well on this album. So I guess that's something that kind of I got from the album, despite it being set in a kind of completely different world from my own. That's something that I felt resonated with me when I listened to it throughout.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's a quality that definitely goes across a lot of Newman's work, and that album Sail Away is a lot of things like that too, in a really heartfelt way.
So the final track on the album is Rollin'. And just a disclaimer for anyone who's listening, that's Limp Bizkit didn't cover that about 30 years later. It's a different Roland. And this is, from what I can gather, it's a track about a man who sort of finds solace in drink.
Yeah, you know, it's the, it's also, you know, Ain't Gonna Worry No More, Ain't Gonna Worry No More. We've had all this album, this whole album full of people worrying and thinking about things and worrying if they're crazy and trying to, you know, in the last song, again, the guy trying to get out of the hospital, you know, what the hell's going on? And you know, here's the answer. You know, I pour myself some whiskey and watch my troubles vanish in the air. You know, and it's, there's a song called, another Newman song called It's Money That I Love. And it's similar in that it's the lyrics talk so much about not worrying anymore that, of course, all you can do is know that this person's still worrying. You know, yeah, try to make it seem so simple. And I think that's what this song does, too. I mean, you know.
And I guess there was a part of it for me where I was thinking to myself, and again, this is the beauty of the songwriting. Has the protagonist found the answer to all his problems? Or is he simply giving up? Is he kind of just telling himself not to worry more than he's telling us that he's not worrying?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's definitely worried. You know, and it's nice to have the album end in a way that is, again, it's certainly not a preachy way for the album to end, which is a relief. You know, if you're going to start with Rednecks is a song and you work your way through all those characters, at the end it's nice to not have it really bogged down in something really like heavy or complicated lyrically. It's like a simple thing,
but I guess at the same time it's still very true to kind of the album and the characters in it.
Oh yeah, I don't think, especially by now, there's no way to just take it as, you know, it's not like anyone's drinking theme song. You know, it's not a drinking song in that way, that's for sure.
So, it's an album from the perspective of drunks, from rednecks, lovesick fools, and governors. And I kind of touched on this before. Is there a danger that because there's just so much going on lyrically and thematically, that we do lose a bit of the focus on the music, which is absolutely fantastic on the album?
You know, I don't think... I think, you know, we're talking about the album and not sitting here listening to clips. I think if you know, as soon as someone starts listening, they'll get all the pleasure from that. If we, you know, if we had little clips mixed in, then it would be easier to talk about it. But, you know, we're thinking about lyrics. But I mean, I the fact that both of those sides, the music and the lyrics, are so incredibly strong, and the album is so cohesive and thematic and intentional in the way it moves, that, you know, that's what kind of puts it at like masterpiece level for me. The fact that all the pieces are so strong.
So, at times, it's a somewhat dark album, but it's always tinged, like we've said throughout, with this very wry sense of humour. Do you think that humour makes it easier for us, and perhaps even Randy Newman himself, to kind of digest the injustices in the world and the things he's talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that these topics are made accessible by the humor and by the simplicity of some of it. You know, and again, it's not a true simplicity, but if we took our conversation about these same topics as we've been trying to just talk about them in Randy Newman songs, and if you made songs out of what we've said, you know, you would end up with something much denser and probably a lot less enjoyable to sit back and listen to, which, you know, which is fine. That's why we're here, is to get people, you know, excited about it and to admire the record. But yeah, I don't think you can get people, you know, music is about pleasure. And if he's just making all of these really, intentionally complicated, hard to follow songs, who want to listen to that? You know, I am very, not trying to pun too much, but I'm very guilty of, I'll crank up that little transition in Kingfish and just rock out to that musically, you know, and not think about all of this. But I sure do admire it and then listen to it quite often for all these things.
So finally, if someone was just to skip right to the end of our conversation and they just wanted to know why they should listen to it, why is this album your classic album and why should people listen to it or buy it or check it out?
For me particularly, I don't think there's any other album that is so poignant and so human in its lyrics and is so well done musically and that really captures the places and the people that it's trying to talk about in just a very true way that you can relate to. It's interesting. It's really interesting.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for picking the album. I personally really enjoyed listening to it and learning more about kind of what kind of the themes and the events that inspired the album. So I'd like to thank you very much for that and for taking the time to come on and talk about it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a big pleasure for me. And I think, again, one of the beautiful things I've learned about being a Randy Newman nerd is that when you find your fellow Randy Newman nerds or people who enjoy it, they tend to be good people to get along with. So, you know, I wish everyone a beautiful journey in finding other Randy Newman fans and nerding out about it or just listening to the records. You know, it's a great pleasure.
Thanks once again to Reed Turchie for taking time out to speak to me about the fantastic album, Randy Newman's Good Old Boys. Now, Reed Turchie's own album, Speaking in Shadows, was released earlier this year on Devil Down Records, and if you're into kind of blues rock, it's an absolute treat, and I would thoroughly recommend it. Rust Magazine said that it moved from mellow moods to riot-instigating sick blues riffs, a good old-fashioned rock and roll blues album with a fresh edge and an original sound. I couldn't have put it any better myself. Reed Turchie's Speaking in Shadows, out now on Devil Down Records. Alternatively, if you want to learn a little more about Reed Turchie, maybe some of his other music that's been out there over the years, get yourself over to reedturchie.com. And that pretty much brings us to the end of this episode of My Classic Album. Just one more piece of business to deal with. You may remember at the beginning of the show, I'd been talking about my meeting with Adrian Nation, and how Adrian had picked a great album to discuss on next month's episode of My Classic Album. I'm now happy to reveal that Adrian chose Time Out of Mind, the classic album that saw a career resurgence for Bob Dylan in 1997. But that's a story for another month. Bob Dylan, Time Out of Mind, for next month's episode of My Classic Album, with myself and Adrian Nation. Until then, I've been Mike Norris, and I'll see you next month.